This is a slightly truncated form of talk I gave a little while ago. I hope I'll have enough time. So I'm just going to get into it. What would a world without the twin structures of heterosexism and misogyny look like? And who would be welcome there? When activists and thinkers try to imagine a place beyond heteropatriarchy, or what Monique Wittig simply calls heterosexuality, a political regime which rests on the submission and the appropriation of women, they sooner or later must answer that double problematic. We frequently find literary responses to these questions in the genre of utopia. In this paper, I'd like to look at what Nicole Brossard's feminist utopian novel, Mauve Desert, has to say on the matter. Mauve Desert, originally published in French in 1987, comprises three parts. The first is a short novel, also called Mauve Desert, ostensibly written by the character Laure Angstel. It tells the story of Mélanie, a 15-year-old girl living in an almost entirely lesbian community in the Arizona desert, and her relationship with the significantly older Angela Parkins. Their affair ends tragically with the eruption of phallocratic violence in the form of Parkins' murder. In the second part of the novel, Maud Laure, a translator in Montreal, finds the original novella and over the course of a year delves into it, fills its gaps, reads between its lines. The result, part three, another novella, Mauve the Horizon, which is a sort of translation, a rewriting of the first part in the same language. This paper, like the novel, will have three parts. In the first, I'll describe the utopia imagined by Mauve Desert. By separating themselves from men, the women in the novel open a breach in patriarchal reality that allows them to forge new relationships to each other and to culture. This emancipation radically alters power relationships between women of different ages, classes, occupations, and in particular between the translator and the author. As for the problem of who would belong in this utopia, I will in a second part examine the process of homogenization that takes place between Mauve Desert and Mauve the Horizon, focusing on the racial marginalization, or whitewashing, this process involves. Finally, I will attempt to situate this homogenization within the social context of North American women's movements. I will suggest that what's been described as an ethos of organizing one's own, typical of U.S. feminisms in the 60s and 70s, might explain Mauve Desert's apparent whitewashing. In my conclusion, I will briefly discuss translation as a sort of built-in mechanism to overcome the separation implied by this ethos. To talk about the issue of race in Mauve Desert, we first need to set the stage by precisely describing the novel's vision of an emancipatory utopia. First, I should introduce our dramatis personae, Laure Angstel, author of Mauve Desert, Mélanie, the 15-year-old protagonist, Angela Parkins, her geometrist lover, Kathy Kerouac, Mélanie's mother and owner of a desert motel, Lorna Meyer, an auto mechanic and Kathy's lover, and Maud Lal, who translates the story into Mauve the Horizon. There is also one male character, but we won't dwell on him because his importance to our problematic is minimal. And it's a lesbian utopia. Monique Wittig's writing proves very useful in interpreting Brossard's novel. Lesbian, Wittig writes, is the only concept I know of which is beyond the categories of sex, woman and man, because the designated subject, lesbian, is not a woman, either economically or politically or ideologically, for it makes a woman is a specific relation to a man, a relation that we had previously called servitude. Pursuing no meaningful interactions with men, the characters in Mauve Desert find themselves in the situation described by Wittig. They are indeed not women, but lesbians. This all-female community enables the creation of what Katherine Perry has described as a liberatory space, or an authentically feminine space. I perceive in Wittig's ideas an interesting modification or an inversion of the Marxist notion which says that the so-called secondary forms of oppression, race, sex, and gender, will be resolved once the dictatorship of the proletariat has taken power. With Wittig, however, it is the establishment of an all-female society that would suspend or attenuate the unequal power relations between, for instance, women of different ages or different classes. The result is what Mélanie herself calls utopia. The example of Kathy... Actually, Quinn, could you hand me my wallet? Sorry. The example of Kathy and Lorna will suffice to demonstrate the suspension of inequality. Their relationship is characterized by an important class differential. Kathy owns a motel, and Lorna, a mechanic, comes from a poor background, grew up in a trailer, she's illiterate. She and Kathy clash over Mélanie, her thoughtfulness, her writing. Lorna complains that Kathy cannot accept her as simply a, quote, body. She contrasts her own embodiedness with Mélanie's intellectualism. As for me, she says, I devour, I take. I don't wait for the twisted lines to make my body breathless and unfit to the point where it can't tolerate good tastes and beautiful images. Your daughter talks about eternity too much. To which Kathy replies, My daughter is subtle. She understands things. And Lorna retorts, and I'm gross, I suppose. Their conversation sketches out an old binarism. Literate, illiterate, rich, poor, intellectual, embodied, civilized, barbarous. Nevertheless, throughout their dispute, it's apparent that neither one disrespects the other, and indeed they move past their differences through their love and their consciousness of the hostility all around them. I quote, "We have no markers but ourselves. We are surrounded by signs that invalidate our presence." The importance here lies not in the tensions typical of interclass couples, but rather the lack of a power play. Kathy does not resort to her education or wealth. Lorna does not call on her experience of poverty as a badge of authority that would delegitimize the other's arguments. A true dialogue occurs, and the dispute is overcome. We find a similar dynamic characterizing Melanie and Angela's interactions. So we see women with different immutable characteristics like age and class origin interacting free of traditional hierarchies. What's more, as I've mentioned, this liberatory space extends beyond accidents of birth to the relationship between author and translator. Translation theorist Laurie Chamberlain catalogs some of the many genderized metaphors of the translator's work based on a fundamental paradigm opposing productive and reproductive work, whereby originality and creativity are described in terms of paternity and authority, relegating the figure of the female to a variety of secondary roles. As regards translation, this paradigm leads to questions of faithfulness and legitimacy, as in sexual reproduction. She concludes that in the metaphoric system explained in her essay, quote, "what the translator claims for himself is precisely the right of paternity. He claims a phallus because this is the only way in a patriarchal code to claim legitimacy for the text." Chamberlain argues that these problems would not disappear in a same-sex author-translator relationship, that a, quote, "feminist translation theory will finally be utopic." And indeed, we are dealing with a utopia, and Canada's feminist translators, provide such a theory. Barbara Goddard, recently passed on, but was a translation theorist and translator at York University, describes how when men encounter women's writing, they often dismiss it as nonsense without meaning for themselves because they have not been taught to understand women's discourse. According to her, this means that, quote, "women's texts are only accessible to those who share the private experience of womanhood." Suzanne de Lavinier Harwood, the feminist translator of Mauve Desert, agrees, and for her this means that for a woman to translate another woman is an act of solidarity between women. She describes translation as a, quote, "rewriting in the feminine," and calls for co-authorship, that's with an E, her. She likes to play games like that. So the co-authorship of a joint project realized in a spirit of solidarity. This relationship to the text, recalling Barthes, enables what Bette Miller names the metonymics of translation, in which an economy of abundance promotes creative rather than recreative activity and incites associative, collaborative, rather than oppositional thinking. So Lo Hongstel and Maud Lal embody this relationship of co-authorship quite neatly. In the beginning, Maud feels the, quote, "panic fear of substituting herself to the author," again with an E, "of this book." She imagines an encounter with Lal and declares, "I have no right, you come before me." but as the work progresses, as her dialogue with Law continues, she declares, "Reading you gives me every right." The work becomes truly collaborative. Maud seeks to become a, quote, "voice both other and alike in the world derived from Lo Hongstel." She begins to refer to the novel as her book, her manuscript. She permits herself to search the wrong side of Law's words with a hint of panic, the double edge, where the scene seemed too cruel or false to her, so that she might modify the story. Her trepidation about creating in her own name dissipates, and finally she indicates in her journal that in her own language she can be the, quote, "substitution of Law." She is free to intervene in the text. She no longer feels bound by the source's authority. I'd argue that this newfound freedom is only possible in the novel because Law and Maud are both lesbians. But all lesbians are obviously not the same. And though power relationships of age and class and profession seem foiled by Utopia and Mauve Desert, there is a troubling homogenization that occurs as the novel brings us from Mauve Desert, the novella, through Maud Lal's translation notebook to Mauve the Horizon. Naturally, a novel written entirely in French that purports to be a meditation on translation cannot be a real translation. It's a simulacrum or a pseudo-translation, in Sherry Simon's words. But Le Désert Mauve in the original French does have a number of borrowings from English, brief phrases, place names. Almost all of these disappear in Mauve l'Horizon, the third part. The source text of de Lavinier Harwood's translation is linguistically homogenous then, and increasingly so. Simon describes this as a, quote, "decision as political as it is aesthetic. Francophone protectionism continues, and doubtless reasonably so, to play a role in the North American context, where French is a very marginalized language." Broussard avoids too much English as a measure to safeguard her subjectivity as a French-Canadian woman or a Québécoise. This seems simple enough, an explanation. However, given Moebius' setting in what was once Mexico, one might expect to see a character explicitly of color. As it stands, the six main female characters all seem to be white. A minor character, however, is most likely Latina, and her fate over the course of the novel's three sections is somewhat problematic. We first meet her in Mauve Desert, the novella, where Melanie describes the time before Lorna's arrival as vague and noisy, like the to and fro of travelers, of suppliers, of the chambermaid. There's nothing exceptional in this account. We don't necessarily know that the chambermaid is Latina. In Modeloff's journal, however, the chambermaid takes on flesh and blood. Mornings, she, quote, says a shy buenos dias to Kathy, both housekeeper and barmaid. She works long days and goes home to three children and a husband who's apparently exclusively interested in the amount of today's tips. The character is a woman, then, in Wittig's sense, a person defined by her relationship to a man, by a man's economic and other exploitation of her, a subaltern. Though her skin color and ethnic background are not spelled out, it does not seem adventurous to suggest, based on her language and her evident class position, that the chambermaid is a Latina woman. Her story, becomes truly interesting. I might go a little bit over time, I'm sorry. Her story becomes truly interesting when we see what happens to her in Modeloff's translation, where once Melanie spoke of the chambermaids to and fro, now, in the time before Lorna's arrival, there is only a busy space filled with customers, salesmen, the continuous hum of the vacuum cleaner. The chambermaid, barely a character in Laura Angstell's text, with a personality and a life sketched out by the translator Modeloff, becomes the continuous hum of the vacuum cleaner in her target text. I've already mentioned the troubling nature of a story taking place in what Gloria Anzaldúa would call La Frontera, with only one Latino or Latina character. Similarly disturbing is the exclusivity, this homogenizing move, this whitewashing seems to create, the denial of entry into Mauve Desert's lesbian utopia. For whom does this utopia exist? Evidently not for Latino women embedded in patriarchal family structures. Does this mean that Broussard or her novel disagrees with the idea of intersectional organizing, which is obviously the idea that women who embrace lesbianism as an ideological, political, and philosophical means of liberation of all women from heterosexual tyranny must also identify with the worldwide struggle of all women to end male supremacist tyranny on all levels, to quote the black lesbian feminist Cheryl Clark. In this last part of the paper, I will attempt to do this very quickly, I will suggest that a possible answer to that question, based on a socio-discursive analysis, social discourse theory attempts, in Marc Angeneau's words, to extrapolate transdiscursive rules, vectors of exchange, and set up a global topology of the prevailing sayable. In this instance, I will point to an axiology widespread in North American women's movements at the time just before Mauve Desert's publication in 1987, and suggest, based on some limited evidence, that one of the topoi of this axiology would indeed have played a role in shaping the novel's relationship to race. I should say, could indeed. The question of who's allowed in the feminist utopia is related, I believe, to the question of coalition building in feminist politics. In her article Organizing One's Own, Benita Roth avers that in contrast to the reading of autonomous feminist organizing of women of color as only a reaction to demonstrably present racism on the part of white feminism, it seems clear that feminists of color were committed to organizing on their own. This ethos of organizing on one's own formed part of the axiology of, quote, good politics, wherein, quote, feminists in all three ethnic communities, black, Chicano, white, agreed among themselves that it was impossible for them to organize across lines of race and ethnicity. I believe this notion derived from the New Left idea that the most authentic and therefore most radical form of activism involved fighting one's own oppression. Do we find traces of this ethos in Quebec feminism? I would like to tentatively claim that we do. In 1978, we see a text written by the Centro Denis Italiani in Montreal, in which the authors call for an autonomous organization for immigrant women to deal with their specific contradictions. José Bello, in her wide-ranging inventory of ethnocultural minority women and their interactions with the mainstream French-Canadian feminist movement in Quebec from the 60s up to the 90s, uncovered many of the same attitudes Roth found in the U.S. Many groups composed of women from the majority, as often as women from minorities, are reticent to transform their mission and their structure to integrate new realities into them. While Roth downplays the possible role of racism in separate organizing in the U.S., Bello confirms that white women in Quebec certainly were less than welcoming to immigrant women and women of color. Nevertheless, so-called ethno-cultural minority women also took it upon themselves to found their own separate groups. I'd like to suggest that these parallels indicate the possible existence of a similar ethos in Quebec. Reading Mauve Desert through the prism of this discourse, then, we might propose that the dramatization of Modeloff's translation and the writing out of the Latina chambermaid could be an acknowledgement of this blind spot. The text signals its own weakness, its own lack of will to deal with issues of race. Perhaps this dramatization is not just whitewashing, though, not just an admission that the text cannot or will not contain a Latina subjectivity. Perhaps it is an incitation as well, a call for translation. The text proposed a relationship between author and translator is marked by openness. the text is burst. And the novel itself has that openness as its constant refrain from the, quote, movement and, quote, speed that characterize Melanie and, quote, open up a passage for her, to the leitmotif of the horizon, the breaks in the clouds, the world's gaping, the very renaming of the novella Mauve the Horizon. Barbara Goddard, in her preface to one of Broussard's other books, writes that under the currently dominant discourse, fiction, imaging, and imagining is the only possible way to effect new boundaries for the real, to postulate new facts or acts or pictures of exchange between women in the plural. And I hasten to add, the most important mode of exchange in fiction is translation. Each new translation is a new interpretation, a new subjectivity fused with the author's. Might the inscription of the Latina chambermaid's disappearance in the text not be a call to co-authorship, to expand Mauve Desert into new subjectivities? Might not the translations of Mauve Desert be the novel's, quote, indispensable complements, as Myriam Suchet has argued, palliating this failing? That hypothesis, however, brings up a host of other questions, which will be the subject of a later paper. Thank you.